This is Sea Change Radio, with news, interviews, and commentary, making connections for sustainability. I'm Bill Bowie.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Growing food, growing community.
Good food, I think, is at the forefront of community development. So we're not just growing food, we're growing community.
That's Will Allen of Growing Power, an organization bringing urban agriculture to the inner city.
Farmers are struggling to make a living at agriculture, and then you also have people who maybe have limited resources. And so the focus of our work in New York City is bringing those two groups together.
And that's Amy Youngblood of Just Food in New York City. We talk with her, together with sustainability educator Scott Kellogg, about the projects they're involved in to make sustainability affordable and accessible to all. That's all coming up on today's Sea Change Radio. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote an article titled Why Posterity Matters. In it, I lauded the efforts of PS 11 in Brooklyn, New York, to educate its young students about the importance of good, fresh food. The kids grow vegetables in the community garden next door. My granddaughter will be starting kindergarten there in a few weeks, so I'm thrilled she'll have a chance to get her hands into the dirt and grow some good food. PS 11 serves a neighborhood that, while beginning to gentrify, is still predominantly poor, one where the problems of obesity and lack of access to affordable, healthy, fresh food are rife and related. How to bring healthy and organic food to low-income communities was a recurrent theme at the recent conference of the Northeast Organic Farming Association, or NOFA. It took place just next to where we produce the show, on the campus of the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Our first guest, Will Allen, was the keynote speaker. He's a leader in the movement to bring affordable organic food to all communities, especially city dwellers who usually can't afford it. But Growing Power, the national organization he founded and directs, is about much more than that. It's about building community by building skills, education, and enterprise in sustainable urban agriculture. Right now, its work is centered in Milwaukee and Chicago and comprises greenhouses, aquaculture operations, and intensive composting. Bill Bowie and I spoke to him outside by the campus pond near the colorful booths of the conference exhibitors. Will Allen, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here at Sea Change Radio.
It's my pleasure.
Now, your organization, Growing Power, you're about growing food. You feed about 50,000 people, I understand. You've said that this is about taking care of each other. And how does Growing Power do that?
Well, I think it's important. One of the things that we've taken for granted, good food, I think, is at the forefront of community development. So we're not just growing food. We're growing community through the food system in communities. Because without a healthy food system, you can't really grow community. So it's really about that. Our work is really concentrated on that. It's a social justice issue to make sure all people have access to the same healthy, good food, which doesn't exist today. It's a lofty goal that we're working on, and it's a goal that really drives me, and it drives many of the people that I work with.
Could you give an example of how you're growing community?
Well, one of the things that in growing community, it really starts with engaging the community, getting the community on board. I don't think we can move forward unless the community really supports what we do. Whether you want to put in a community garden, a lot of time outsiders come into community and say, well, you all need a community garden, so we're going to slap a bunch of community gardens on this vacant land. Well, the people aren't just going to jump out of their homes and run out to those fields and say, hallelujah, we've got a place to garden. And plus, you have to understand those communities, because many of those communities may have 5 or 10 people that are really the keys to the community, because they're the longtime residents, and many of the other people are transient that may be in the community this month but be out of the community. So you have to engage those people first. If you're going to totally get engaged. So it really starts with that. You shouldn't move forward unless you organize the people and get them on board in the community, because you know, starting to grow food or grow soil or whatever you plan to do, it'll never work. It'll never sustain itself.
Now, you started with a youth project. Is this the way in, you feel? Is that the best way in to begin working with people, is to work with their children?
Yeah, I think working with the youth is probably the easiest way to engage the community, because the youth are the easiest to work with. The younger they are, the easier it becomes to work with them, because they're wide-eyed and open-minded. They don't bring a lot of baggage into play, and they know what's going on in the community. So I think it's very important. Once you get the youth involved, then they bring the adults along. And then you have this multi-generational piece working, because I don't think you can have these successful projects without it being multi-generational. I always advise groups that they should try to engage the youth if they want to make headway, because it's very difficult to get a project started without having the kids involved.
And when I hear talk about youth, I think about education and the role of that. So what can you teach and mentor for the youth, and what do you and your peers learn from the youth?
Well, one of the things that we've learned is that we have very bad educational systems in most of these inner cities, and that many of the kids that we work with can't really read or write. So when they come into our program, I understood that we had to do more than just teach them hands-on stuff. But hands-on stuff really led to these young people wanting to get more involved in the academic world by wanting to learn more, by digging deeper, by wanting to research some of the things. Like, for example, if we're talking about microorganisms in the soil, and show them a slide of soil with all the different bugs, the microbes, then they want to know what are the name of these microbes. And we tell them, well, you get online and look them up, you know, see if you can find the shapes of them. And that seems to have spurred a lot of our young people to learn and have improved their grades and their reading abilities. And then we added a two-hour academic piece for our younger kids that's related to the work that they're doing in a hands-on way every day.
2 hours every day then?
Yes, they do some reading and writing about what they've done in a physical way around the farm.
Now, you're feeding a lot of people, 50,000. You're in two large communities, that's Chicago and Milwaukee. I wonder if you think that that kind of urban agriculture, the scale that you have been able to achieve with this, is sufficient for feeding people in cities, or can it be made sufficient, or is urban agriculture always going to need globalized agriculture or big agriculture?
Well, I think we're always going to have this big ag model to some degree, but I think we can cut into that model. We need about 50 million people growing food, new people growing food in this country, to fundamentally change the industrial ag model. And I'm not talking about 50 million farmers. I'm talking about 50 million people growing in their backyards and side yards and in containers on their balconies or whatever. Community gardens, community farms. But we need to ramp it up. We have a lot of youth projects around the country, thousands of them now. But now we need to ramp up the production. And to do that, we're going to have to grow new soil. We've got to use the resources that we have in those cities, the carbon and nitrogen waste that's going into the landfills to compost. We need thousands and thousands of yards of compost to grow healthy, good food, because it's not responsible to grow in the toxic soils that we have in our cities and our suburban areas and in our rural areas. So it's really important for us to really start doing that. So there's a lot to be learned. There's a lot of work to be done, but the enthusiasm is there. This isn't a movement anymore, it's a revolution. But we need to grow this revolution, and we need to attack some of these problems. Now is the time to really start doing stuff instead of just talking about it. Mm-hmm. So it's about, you know, getting out and getting something started, no matter how small it is, and then growing that.
I asked Will Allen what answer he would give to those who say organic agriculture is elitist because it can't possibly feed the poor of the world. It's too inefficient and expensive.
Well, I guess my answer to that is that this GMO, large-scale industrial, and you know, people like Michael Pollan, others have framed it very well, has not led us down the road to prosperity. As a matter of fact, has led us to the most unhealthy time in creation. So that's a pretty easy answer that, you know, we need this stuff that hasn't worked. We have a million less farmers than we had in 1960. So this industrial model has led us to prosperity and will lead us in the future. That's a bunch of nonsense. They've had their chance. Now it's time for us to go smaller scale, more intensive, local, so people can start taking control of their lives and expecting this big big brother monster industrial ag to take care of us. So like I said, this movement is now a revolution. Most pleasing piece for me is to see a lot of people of color join the revolution. And I think when you see that happen, then you know you really made some impact, because those are the people that used to grow good food under duress, being discriminated against, being under in slavery, and our immigrants who lost their land in foreign countries to move to America. Those are the people that are coming back, joining the revolution. So I guess that's my answer. This smaller scale piece is the answer. 84% of people want locally grown food. And last survey, so the vast majority of people want to see this grow into a revolution of smaller scale farms and people that they can come into contact with and understand where their food comes, because people are afraid of food that's being shipped from all over the world. They don't know whether it's safe. We've had all these food scares, and we've had so many people being sick, and look at the latest studies by Robert Wood Johnson on obesity and so forth. And so I think we have enough evidence to say that smaller scale is better.
Will Allen of Growing Power. He was just awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant for his work. He spoke to us at the Northeast Organic Farming Association conference that took place at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst on the weekend of August 8th. Our next guest presented workshops at the NOFA conference that both emphasize making sustainability affordable to everyone, including people living in low-income urban neighborhoods. Abby Youngblood coordinates a program called Fresh Food for All. It's run out of Just Food, a nonprofit in New York City that works to establish a strong regional food system that's socially just as well as environmentally sound. And Scott Kellogg is the co-founder of the Rhizome Collective of Austin, Texas, an education project promoting affordable sustainability. He's now moved to Albany, New York, where he's replicating the project under the name of Radix. Kellogg is also author of the book, Toolbox for Sustainable City Living. Well, I want to welcome both of you, Scott Kellogg and Amy Youngblood, to See Change Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Abby, let's start with you. Talk a little bit about what your project is and why it began, how it began in New York City.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have two groups of people that we're working with in New York City. We're working with New York City citizens, and like you said, working with all kinds of people, really working in all communities and neighborhoods in New York City. And we're trying to bring those folks together with farmers in the state. And you have two different groups. Farmers are struggling to make a living at agriculture, and then you also have people who maybe have limited resources. And so the focus of our work in New York City is bringing those two groups together. And the mission of our organization, Just Food, is to support the work of regional family farmers and also to support people who are growing food within an urban environment. And through supporting both of those groups, try to make good quality, nutritious food available to people who maybe haven't had access to it.
And your name says a lot, it packs a lot into those two words, Just Food. Scott, I just attended your workshop on sustainable, on tools for sustainable urban living. You began your discussion, your presentation, with talking about sustainability as a social justice issue. Could you explain what that means?
Certainly. I'm the co-founder of an organization in Austin, Texas. We were called the Rhizome Collective, a nonprofit organization. And what we did is we took an old warehouse building and converted it into a space that had a two-part purpose to be, one, what we called a center for community organizing, where we provided low-rent space to a number of different social and activist organizations. And we also developed what we called a center for urban sustainability education, where we had on display numerous ecological tools and technologies that are designed to teach urban residents how to have more local access and control over life's essential resources, chiefly being food among them, but additionally waste management, energy production. And our intention was to, by having these two functions under the same roof, to have the lines between social justice and ecological sustainability movements be more visibly drawn. We believe to have a really holistic understanding of what sustainability it is, it needs to be mindful of social justice and economic justice issues just as much as it's about sustainable food production and about environmental protection, that these things are completely interrelated with each other and together create a holistic concept of sustainability.
In this idea that sustainability really needs to be connected up with social justice, I mean, here we are in a time of economic crisis. Many in the green movement are talking about how this presents great opportunity for green business, for jobs, and also for better sustainable farming practices. I'd like to ask you, how do you see this among the people with whom you're working? How are they taking in this message of sustainability?
Well, you know, I'd like to say that having access to some land to grow some of your own food, what can be more empowering than having control over your food? And so, you know, that's something that people, even in an urban environment, are really excited to be able to have access to a place to grow some of their own food and to knowing who's growing their food. And there's really a growing movement in New York City, an urban agriculture movement, and especially with the economic situation right now, people are interested in being able to garden and save money and have access to organic food that maybe is expensive to buy. I think that that connects people, starting with growing your own food, it connects people to some of the larger issues surrounding, for example, global climate change and some of the other issues that we're facing.
And are you finding that people are responding to your message who are in middle and lower income communities?
The model that we use at Just Food is a training of trainers model. And so our philosophy is really to work with community gardeners and people who are already have the knowledge of how to grow food in an urban environment. And you find really vibrant community gardens all over the city. And so that's kind of the base, the core of the people that we work with.
And Scott, in your workshop, you have many ingenious examples of how urban residents can actually enhance the amount of area that they have to grow food, and using many kind of found or inexpensive ways of doing that. I'd like to ask you first, tell us, what are some of the advantages that actually cities might have in terms of growing food and producing their own energy?
Well, the design philosophy that's based, a lot of our work is based upon, is called permaculture. And in a nutshell, what that is about is designing intensely cultivated systems that are capable of providing for as many of our own needs as possible in as small of a space as possible. In that regard, cities are ideal because they already are so intensely cultivated, and there's a lot of existing infrastructure there that we can work with, whether that's old warehouses, empty vacant lots, the rooftops of buildings. All these spaces through time and work can be converted so that they can be providing with us with a lot of our own needs, that we can be producing much of our own caloric needs within the boundaries of a city. We also have the advantage of, in the city, of living on top of mountains of waste, which many might see as being a drawback, but it's actually an opportunity there. This enormous amount of food waste and organic matter that is collected in cities each day, that's actually brought into cities and then taken to landfills, is stuff that we can actually intercept and compost and turn into dirt to be building gardens for urban populations. And doing this work is actually a lot easier in cities because the distance that you have to travel and the relative energy inputs are much less than if you were doing the same work in a rural area.
I'm just really excited by what you're describing and seeing some of that happening. I'm seeing more and more people, for example, using worms to compost their food waste within their apartment, thinking about ways to cycle waste within the urban environment and close that loop. I've seen people in New York City who are keeping bees on their rooftops, and so I think there are a lot of really exciting opportunities. You were talking before about economic opportunities related to doing environmental work. What are the economic opportunities of, for example, beekeeping in the urban environment? The advantages, you have the market right there for your product. People would gladly buy your honey at the farmers market in the city. And so thinking about how we can use urban agriculture as a way of teaching people business skills, engaging youth in creating products that they can sell at a farmers market, that's another exciting opportunity, I think.
I wonder, Scott, if you could describe some of the systems that you set up in Austin and are setting up in Albany now, in Albany, New York. So if you could talk about maybe the fish and the composting, the flies that you used for composting, which were not regular house flies, and just give us a little mini idea of how some things could work together at an affordable level for communities.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's important that you mention that because a huge aspect of our work is on developing systems that are affordable, because the term sustainability we see more and more often as being used as a marketing term to sell products, but we have to really bring it back to its truer original meaning, which is about living in such a way that the resources available to us are going to be available to an indefinite number of future human generations, and making sustainability something that is accessible to the majority of the world as well. And a lot of people, when they hear about sustainability, they might think, oh, well, that's great, but how is it relevant to me, when they're just struggling to make ends meet? So, I mean, I think that's a huge part of the struggle, is to figure out, you know, well, how can microeconomic opportunities be created in the city? And I think there's a lot of potential to be doing that. Raising bees is one example that was already mentioned. Aquaculture is one thing that I'm exploring quite a bit, about raising fish primarily, but also edible and useful aquatic plants in small-scale, intensive sort of recirculating pond systems that use the wastes produced by fish to actually be nutrients for plants as well. Raising chickens, definitely something to be done in cities. People can be selling eggs to neighbors. And composting, there's an enormous potential industry in waste recycling in cities of taking food waste and turning it into soil, which is something we really need to be doing to be building deep, intensive garden beds so we can be growing food close together. Using red wigglers is one way to do that. And one you also mentioned before that I was talking about in the workshop is using the black soldier fly, which is a type of insect that is capable of turning putrescent wastes, things like meats and dairies, which traditionally are kind of difficult to compost, into an incredibly rich fertilizer that can be used as a soil amendment.
You're listening to Sea Change Radio. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And here with me in the studio are Scott Kellogg, author of Toolbox for Sustainable City Living, and Abby Youngblood joins us from Just Food in New York City. So, Abby, I know that there are even farms in New York City, like the Red Hook Farm in Brooklyn, but there's also an awful lot of asphalt. How could one increase a space in cities so you can ramp up the scale of agricultural production?
As you mentioned, we have a lot of asphalt in the city, and it's interesting that the farm you mentioned in Red Hook, which is associated with an organization called Added Value, which works with youth in the area, that urban farm, I believe it's about half an acre, and it's literally built up off of the asphalt. And so that is one option. And then another option is there are pockets of land in New York City that are could be more fully utilized. The community garden that I'm part of is a piece of land that's next to the highway, so it's less desirable for housing, but it's a good space for growing food. with quite a bit of sunlight, and we have mulberry trees and fig trees and peach trees, plus vegetables growing in that space. So thinking about how we can utilize those spaces, and I think it's also a question of urban planning and really asking policymakers to be aware of the issue as we're looking towards how we use space in the city to make available space for food growing. And then another idea that I'm just seeing in New York City catching on is using rooftop spaces to grow food. And I think it's an interesting idea to explore. I think there are some challenges with thinking about how to make that affordable. Maybe Scott knows more about that.
When we look at cities and we think, well, where does the sun actually fall? That's the challenge, because in order to be growing most food crops, we need close to direct sun. And most of that sunlight is falling on the rooftops of buildings. It's unfortunate that most older buildings are not structurally capable of taking the weight of wet soil. So this is something I've been researching quite a bit about. I mean, there's a growing interest in what are called green roofs. They're really most practical just for new construction. So how much potential there is for them for the average urban resident is yet to be seen, yet to be determined. I've seen, though, some pretty exciting examples of people doing just rooftop gardens. If anything, just on the brick parapets that circle buildings, there's a lot of potential to be growing food there as well. But certainly taking advantage of window boxes is something that can be done. I've seen some exciting designs for actually using the vertical face, south-facing face of buildings for growing food on. It seems a little more of a top-down high engineering solution, but I think there needs to be sort of collaborations between grassroots and a top-down level in order to implement some of these strategies. Because, yeah, we are going to have to maximize just about every amount of space that is available for food production in urban areas.
Talking about policy, I know one problem that people can run into is that municipal laws may forbid sustainable activities like growing livestock, chickens or rabbits, or installing a compost toilet. I know you have some thoughts on this, Scott.
We have come to the realization that so many of the sustainable technologies and techniques that we are advocating are in many places illegal to implement, whether it's having chickens or just doing wastewater recycling or even composting in a lot of places, and in some states even something as simple as rainwater collection. So I think what we really need to do is, as more and more towns and municipalities are becoming interested in sustainable and green technologies, is develop a code that is compatible with these ideas and these techniques. There's some exciting work already being done in this area. There's an organization in Portland, Oregon called Recode Portland, whose goal is to change city codes that would basically legalize sustainability. So far, they've actually managed to create a statewide law for gray water reuse, which is very exciting. And I'm interested in starting such a similar movement here in the Northeast.
That's wonderful. Is that also something that you guys have at Just Food have come into contact with or problems with?
Definitely. And we recently had a campaign to legalize beekeeping in New York City. We're lucky that keeping chickens within the city is legal, and many people are keeping chickens. Beekeeping is something that's happening within the city, and what we found is that the law that was on the books was actually a very old law, and when we went to the Department of Health to address it, and when we mobilized people within the city who understood the importance of keeping bees, both the pollination and the benefits of having bees in the city, we were able to draw enough attention to the issue that I think we will be successful in getting that law changed. And so I think it comes back to one of the issues that you mentioned earlier of building awareness and building community, and being able to then mobilize people to have those laws changed.
Well, thanks so much, Abby Youngblood of Just Food in New York City, and Scott Kellogg of RADx, a sustainability education project in Albany, New York.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Sea Change Radio. This week's show was produced by Francesca Rhiannon,
with production assistance from Bill Bowie. Our theme music is by Sanford Lewis. Chris Brainerd and Tanya Hart are the Sea Change interns, and Bill Way is our web dude.
Check out seachange.net to download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Tune in next week for more on the shift to sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Bill Bowie.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon.